This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the leadership platform, multiplying authentic, seamless leaders and moving the self, others and society in the process. That's what we're all about. All about leadership. It's the leadership platform. I'm Adrian Groenewald, and with me, the old man, Louis Groenewald. Welcome, Louis.
Good to be here with you and with our special guest.
Yeah, it's great to have a weekly leadership masterclass. Go to leadershipplatform.com for all things leadership. One word, two P's in the middle. Our leadership masterclass today is with Dr. Andrew Johnson, the CLO at Eskom, Chief Learning Officer at Eskom, and it's a big job. We're at the campus where a lot of this action takes place, sort of Midrand area. And it's huge, man. I feel like I'm at UJ. There's sort of the style as well, you know, of the building and everything else. Andrew, it's good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us on the Leadership Platform.
Thanks very much, Adrian, for the opportunity, and good morning to Louis also.
This is a Leadership Platform. We've had all kinds of leaders on it in various forms. We thought it would be really exciting to talk to you about leadership. You're an expert on various fronts. You've done your PhD. That's an interesting theme. But there's a couple of themes that I think you could take us through, and we could have a nice discussion here for our masterclass. But just the job alone within the environment of Eskom, we can learn from you there. I mean, sure. It hasn't been easy. It's not going to be easy from here on forward. Although, like South Africa, there's a lot of hope, yep. I think, in Eskom, and there's a lot of hope in South Africa with everything happening as well.
Sure.
But let's just start from the beginning. I mean, Chief Learning Officer at Eskom, that's a... Just give us an overview of what that means, and then we'll look at your background a little bit.
Sure.
And then we'll start looking at your feelings regarding the future of leadership.
Thanks, Adrian. The Chief Learning Officer for Eskom is responsible for all the learning and development in this environment. That includes all the technical training, that is your engineering and artisan training, the functional training, which has to do with all our business skills training, like safety or customer service or HR, finance, security, IT, and so forth. And then the third component to it is leadership development, which includes all your supervisory and management development. The actual institution, while this is the main campus, finds itself in 28 sites around the country, because Eskom is a national organization and we obviously have to deliver the training where we find our customers. And we would find that in all of the provinces of South Africa. So we're responsible for the whole spectrum of learning delivery to Eskom across those three main components, which I just shared with you.
Andrew, that's huge. Yeah, I mean, just doing the one third of that, let's say the leadership, all the leadership, that's big.
Yeah.
Then you go to functional, which is all the business skills stuff, yeah. The MBAs, the right. Management skills, and then the technical, which obviously is possibly the biggest portion of it, because...
And our core business.
It's your yeah. core business. Mm. It's just, we're not talking a couple of million rand, the business. This is a big organization that you lead. Yeah. You've been doing it for a little while?
I've been in the job now. I was appointed in 2016. So it's just over a year that I've been in the role now. In the past, the academy used to run separately, just with that functional and technical. And the leadership used to be a separate entity as what was called then the Leadership Institute of Eskom. So it was a separate entity. And then when we amalgamated both things, I was then appointed to take over the role.
You're an industrial psychologist by trade, yes?
That's correct, yeah.
Where did you do that?
I did, undergraduate studies in South Africa in psychology up to honors level. And then I got a break to do my Master of Science in Occupational Psychology, as it's called, in England, and managed to go to Nottingham University to do my Occupational Psychology. I had a particular problem because my undergraduate studies and up to honors level was leaning towards clinical psychology. Mm. And when I did want to make the switch in South Africa, you couldn't really do it because you had to do undergraduate industrial psychology to go into that space. Whereas in England, up to honours level, you could do a kind of a general psychology degree, and you only specialise for your master's afterwards. That's why I managed to get into the programme. And it was just one of those amazing breaks in my life, because I got selected. I had not even the faintest hope that I would ever be able to get in the program. And then I got selected for a class of 16 from around the world.
That's exciting. It's a good experience, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just the context, then you're back here.
And then I came back to South Africa. I did my internship in South Africa in industrial psychology, qualified as an industrial psychologist, and then pursued my doctorate with the University of Johannesburg.
Your doctorate theme? I'm always interested in that.
It's about the role of mental models in enhancing effective leadership behavior. So it was around leadership. I had a very particular keen interest in that particular field.
Okay, we can break it down a little later on in our masterclass. But what's the essence there? Mental models? Example?
The mental models is a concept that comes from Peter Senge. If you read his book, actually, The Fifth Discipline, the fifth discipline is about mental models. Oh. And basically it is, if one could describe it in very simplistic terms, a mental model is a particular way of belief that you have that determines how you would behave towards something. Now, the idea behind mental models in effective or ineffective leadership behavior is to say, if you hold a particular belief of how the thing should happen, that's going to determine how you're going to act it out. And it will have certain consequences. Now, so I was very interested in this. But the key person actually that Senge himself also learned from is Chris Argyris. He just died about 2-3 years ago now, who is kind of considered to be the father of organizational learning.
Okay.
And he speaks of it not so much as mental models, he called it our governing values. What governs how do we behave and then create consequences in terms of our behavior.
Okay.
And we'll explore that a little bit more. But it's basically a set of beliefs that you have in your head, which often operates at the tacit or an unconscious level, that you act out in terms of your particular behavior, and often leading to consequences that we didn't intend in the first instance, because the mental model operates at a tacit level. It's not in your conscious kind of attention, which means it drives your behavior, but in a way that you need to get to understand what is this mental model about. But I'll explicate a little bit more about that later.
The forefront of our mind today, you know, this is the day where we all wake up to the fact that our president resigned.
Sure.
Jacob Zuma, we have a new acting president who will probably be the president. And let's not discuss it now, but I'll tell you in my mind, I think, what kind of mental models exist for someone to never take blame? You know, to actually, even in your resignation conversation, you still have that final word that says, you know, what is this for? What have I done wrong? So that's a whole new conversation.
Sure,
but that's typically what I think of in the reality of today. What beliefs drive that sort of behavior all the time? But leadership is a fascinating concept. Before we go into, let's say, the future of leadership, because I think that was in part your contribution to this leadership Bible that people can buy. I forget what it was called now.
Leadership Perspectives from the Frontline.
That's right.
I co-edited with Professor Theo Feltsman.
Yeah, Leadership Perspectives from the Frontline. And I had some contribution there. It's a magnificent thick book. It's like a Bible, isn't it, for leadership. And it's Future of Leadership. But just tell us where you come from. I mean, your background. I was with a colleague the other day who's the HR exec of Spar, and I didn't even know, after knowing her for a year, and spending a lot of hours with her, that she has a PhD. And when she told her story, I'm going to put her on the show. It's just fascinating where she comes from.
Right.
But where do you come from? We know where you are today.
It's quite an amazing thing, because I think I'm one of those products that come out of that very interesting place in South Africa called the Karoo, which we often like so much. I grew up in the Karoo in a very small town called Craddock. I was born there in the 60s. I went to school there, both primary and high school. The high school was in particularly a very interesting experience for me because that was run by Roman Catholic Dominican sisters. The high school was called Holy Rosary.
Okay.
And I think, if I think back in terms of that particular school, it's probably the school that gave so many young people like myself an opportunity in life because these were German nuns. Now, if you have ever been taught by or worked with Germans, it's very regimented.
German nun, I can imagine.
Incredibly regimented. But they also, and I think partly because they came from Europe, obviously, they brought a mindset of education that was very different to what we would have experienced, say, in a state school. So it's an openness about education, but also exploring things that they would have obviously had exposure to as students themselves, and bringing this into that environment for us. Now, it's a very impoverished community that you're talking about, and yet the excellence with which they kind of approached that learning really just gave us a push start in life that was incredible. And in that small community gave a lot of young people and kids an opportunity to explore further in life and just to see that there was a world bigger than Craddock, you know. I mean, I must tell you just very briefly that when I went to England, it was my first time to step out of South Africa. And it was also at the time when I left the old South Africa because this was in 93.
Oh, boy.
And I came back in 94, which was the new South Africa. So I was in that transition phase, actually, in England, you know, which is a fascinating experience. But what I wanted to say about it in relation to where I grew up was it was almost the first time that I looked back at our country from outside of it, you know, and just to experience it in a very different light to what, unfortunately, because there was so much emphasis at that time by news agencies on South Africa because of the elections and the transition to a democratic government, we had lots of news. I mean, we were just overwhelmed with news in England, so I didn't have, and quite interestingly, the day after the election, the news died down. So, but leading up to it was just an incredible experience. But so Craddock was a very small community. I mean, the biggest city that I knew at the time was probably between, say, Port Elizabeth and East London, you know. And first time when I came to Joburg, I just felt like, sure, I mean, I've never known that the world could be that big.
What did you come to the city for? What did you want to become initially? And then we can move on.
Initially, I actually trained as a Catholic priest. I was a Dominican monk in or friar, as it's called, at one point in my life. So I spent quite a bit of my life in that environment.
I can see you as that.
Say again?
I can see you as that. Yeah, I can.
Yeah.
All right.
They attracted me very much because of also their social justice involvement in South Africa. But also, if you think back to the Dominicans in the Middle Ages, was very much the intelligentsia of the Catholic Church. They were the ones infamously known to have conducted the, you know, all the Inquisition inquiries in the Middle Ages and, you know, condemning people as witches and all sort of things. But they were considered to be kind of the people running universities in the Catholic Church at that time, yeah. So I spent quite a bit of time with them and, yeah, their exposure with them. But I also studied at the university at the same time. So I did kind of theological, philosophical studies with them, but also studied, you know, at UNISA at the time doing some undergraduate studies. Okay. Yeah.
Well, from Craddock, and everything outside of Craddock is bigger than Craddock.
Oh, absolutely.
To the big cities and a very big job, but also big opinions and views on leadership. It's one of those nice stories, eh, Louis?
I'd just like to mention, from a leadership point of view, Andrew, you can see how your profile is formed because of certain mindsets you had. Yeah. I mean, many people will blame the rigid control by the Catholic sisters as a big factor. You recognize that with a smile, but what you do emphasize is this discipline of excellence.
Yes.
Which they brought to you. It's amazing how people react differently. Instead of complaining and blaming, you know, became building blocks in your life, and that's formed your whole character.
Absolutely. And maybe just to touch on that point, I think if you look at how they structured and regimented they were about it, they actually did it out of love, because you had a sense they have an interest to develop you to a higher level, that maybe you have to learn this discipline in yourself, that discover that you have great gifts in yourself, and help develop it throughout your life.
So
but to be disciplined about it, because you can't just sit around and wait by chance for things to happen.
You see, going out in from leadership development, as we know, the basic is the confidence you have in the potential of people. And this is what you're saying, they had it.
Absolutely.
And they felt by this so-called discipline, you can reach that potential. Without it, you can't.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
Dr. Andrew Johnson, the future of leadership. I think we're all interested in that. If you're interested in leadership, you must be interested in the future of leadership.
Sure.
We're certainly interested in the future of leadership in our country, but globally. So let's just have an overall conversation around that. What was your contribution to the Leadership Bible as well?
Sure.
And maybe expand a few minutes around that theme.
As you know, the book itself is quite a thick book, some 1,000 pages, if I count correctly. And we ask experts, obviously, from various angles to comment on leadership, whether that is from a neuro-leadership perspective or a psychodynamic perspective, and also speaking about leadership applications in different contexts, whether it's schools or women leadership, what kind of attributes do you need for that?
Government or
government and so forth. I think in the end, when Theo and I looked at it, who is the co-editor for me, and we look at all of these contributions, invariably each one of those experts had particular competencies that they said were necessary for a leader to operate in this VUCA world, as it is commonly known. And
volatile, uncertain,
Complex,
ambiguous. That's right.
So this world that we operate in, they all had a comment to make. So if you want to be an excellent leader to deal with diversity, you need these competencies. If you want to play in the school environment, you need these competencies. I can tell you, if you look at that list, it is incredibly long, which is also an intent to respond to the incredibly long list of challenges emerging out of all of these contexts. And clearly, if you look at it, you almost are saying, well, this leader has to deal with so many challenges, and he needs so many competencies. Is that even possible? You know? I mean,
good question.
Yeah. Is it even possible that a leader could have this whole long list of competencies and play effectively? It clearly is not possible.
I just want to quickly say, I've often had conversations with a bunch of senior leaders in the room and say, on this flip chart page, let's put down the competencies of a great leader. And when that all those list competencies are there, you look at them and you say, that looks like perfection.
Yes.
Can anyone ever do that? I mean, it's not possible because we're human.
It's but clearly not.
Continue.
And so we had to we looked at that and we say, well, a leader then have to play. One of the things that we did, by the way, as we started off with the book, was to put leadership in some kind of framework to say a leader need to develop in even in relation to these various contexts that we were talking about. A leader needs to develop competencies that help him to manage himself. So it's about yourself. It's then secondly about the others around you, the teams that you play with, or whether that be your own natural team or project teams that you find yourself in. Then a leader has to lead within his organization, kind of the third layer. And the fourth layer to be, how do you lead in this broader world that your organization finds yourself in? Mm. And you can just imagine, what we were trying to do then is to say there are competencies associated, given the context that leaders find themselves in this VUCA world, given that context, the leader needs certain competencies in each one of those four layers to be able to play effectively in that world. And as I've just indicated and you confirmed, when a leader look at that and he says, no, it's not possible, I can't develop all of these competencies. Clearly, from a practical point of view, you can't. And so it led us to the idea to say, well, you know, there is this whole long list of competencies. Maybe we can begin to refine it to kind of competency themes about, it is about authentic leadership. It is about leadership that shows servant leadership towards others and what are the implications of it and so forth. And so we came up with five themes, but we even felt in those five themes, you have to break it down further and you'll probably come up, say, with another. So we had five themes, but in the five themes, you would break it down into five competencies. Mm. 25 competencies? Nah, maybe not, you know. It's
still a lot, but
so
let's keep some people.
It led us to the idea that maybe this new leadership style is requiring the leader to have a deep contextual appreciation of what he's dealing with. And that could almost be moment to moment. And that's a very different skill. You see, this is a mental model. Hmm. If a leader believes that we find ourselves, maybe described with this VUCA concept, if a leader finds himself that the world we operate in, just because of this exponential change we're dealing with, he finds himself in a context of chaos, then he has to shift how he thinks about it. Let me just tell you why that could be the mental model that could help a leader to think differently. A leader could also say, and this is invariably what leaders do say, is, I find it incredibly difficult to manage my work, my family life, my social life, my academic life, if you want to pursue further education, all at the same time. And therefore, I'm not going to do training right now because I have to focus on my work. Mm. So a leader would say, often we hear leaders saying, I can't come to the training now to do this leadership development because I've got too much on my plate. Now, what is the mental model that drives that leader? The mental model is that somewhere in the future, a time will arrive where all of these things will balance out. But we know that that is a lie. Mm. It's not going to happen.
No, it's not.
It's not possible. In fact, that world is just moving faster and faster to create even more chaos around us. Now, if you were helping this leader to switch the mental model to say, maybe I'm only dealing with chaos to a bigger or lesser extent, it says, I must deal with the chaos and not wait for a time in the future, because that's a different mental model. Yeah. I must step up to this thing now to deal with this situation. I don't know how to do it, but I must look for the skills to do so. That is contextual appreciation, because you're dealing with what is served you in this moment. And so it led us to the idea that maybe there's a very different way that we can speak about the competencies that leaders need to develop. And maybe we just put this out as a kind of teaser for people to think about, is maybe the only skill a leader actually needs is skillful improvisation. Because skillful improvisation is asking you to step up to the situation as you find it right now and try and respond in the best possible way to that situation.
Mm. Now, skillful
improvisation.
I mean, just to bring the reality, not to throw you off balance, but I was sitting with an executive this week, and the first thing, how are you doing? What space are you in? Just crazy. Honestly, I cannot spend quality time on any area of my life. And as we explored a little bit further, it came down to, but maybe if this acquisition that we're involved with comes to an end and it's all settled down, maybe then it'll. So I said, you're assuming that there won't be another acquisition.
Exactly.
Or that there'll be something else takes its space.
Yeah.
So I said, what would it mean for you if
exactly.
that assumption was wrong? You know.
Yeah.
So we had that conversation. It is real what you're saying.
Yeah.
We know it. The leaders listening right now know that they feel that way. You're just touching the surface of everything, and you feel like you can't go in depth into any area of your life.
Yes, yes. And maybe that is all that we are facing right now, and maybe it's going to get worse until we find better ways to say, that is the chaos that you're dealing with, so how do you step up to that? Not this wishful thinking that at some point in the future
things will be predictable,
it will settle
again.
Itself, you know. No. But that also forces a kind of paralysis in people, because you don't have to do anything now then, because that thing will sort itself out one way or another. A skillful improvisation has got many implications, because it's saying also the way that we train leaders has to shift. And maybe in that regard, which is one of the points that we make in the book, is we have to go and learn about how that development happens, not from our traditional business schools, but maybe we should go and ask the artists, because artists are brilliant at improvisation. And one particular form of art that has fascinated me a lot is jazz, in fact. And I just want to share the idea that I had around this as we were talking about it in terms of improvisation. And I was making the point then to say jazz artists actually understand best what improvisation is. Here's a scenario. They prepare for a gig that they're going to play on Saturday, and they practice a lot, and they go through all the motions of, you know, setting themselves up to play a big piece on Saturday. But invariably, if you know, if you ever spoke to jazz artists, there's always a mistake that is made. And in fact, in all art forms you have to make, mistakes are made. So they play the piece now this evening for the audience, and somebody makes a mistake. Just by the way, the audience never knows that the jazz artists have made a mistake. And the reason for that is the following. Somebody makes a mistake on playing the wrong note, maybe, and they say, the jazz band leader says, there's no mistake on the bandstand. The only mistake is there is the inability of the other person to respond to the mistake that was made in the first instance. So what happens is that when a mistake is made, the other players around you tune into the mistake to just take it on as if it is part of the piece of music that you're playing. And that's why you will never hear that there's a mistake in jazz, because they flow with what is there. It's a bit like what Donald Sherrn, who was a great collaborator of Chris Argyris, the two of them jointly being considered as the fathers of organizational learning. Donald Sherrn says, it's developing the skill to deal with the back talk of the situation. And by that he means, so you have prepared yourself well to do a particular thing, but you can never control what happens in your environment. And so something happens that kind of throws you a little bit off course. The situation talks back to you in a way that you haven't prepared for it, like this mistake that is made on the bandstand. But you tune into the mistake rather than to have a persistence to deal with how you have prepared to respond to the issues. You kind of, it's almost like, I mean, in common terms we say about how do you think on your feet as you stand in that situation? And that is what skillful improvisation is about, is the situation shifts all the time. And because of the kind of world that we operate in, this VUCA world, that situation is very uncertain what is going to happen next. The question then is, how comfortable are you to step back from it and say, wow, this is a big thing that is thrown to me now. How do I respond to this particular situation? What we're not proposing is to say all of those skills, the 25, for example, we spoke about earlier, are useless. We're not saying that. We say that development needs to take place for leaders to learn, how do you respond to people? How do you respond to your task? And so forth. The difference is, when you apply the concept of skillful improvisation, you know which skill, you make first of all the correct judgment of your situation, and therefore know which of those skill sets are you going to call upon to help you resolve it.
So, skillful improvisation, but it is preceded by good preparation. Louis? Old man, your comment on that. I mean, that's what we're saying. There's no space for saying I don't have to prepare myself.
Absolutely.
I'm a guy who thinks by the seat of my pants. Indeed. I think on my feet, so I don't need any of this training.
No. And that's precisely why I say you actually do need the skills development in those other leadership competencies, but they sit as a toolkit that you call upon depending on what the situation demands on you.
hardly in terms of our language, this is exactly the spirit of the inner me model, make no mistake. Andrew, what you're saying rings very, very deep-rooted bells. I appreciate so much because by nature I'm a creative writer.
Right.
And I believe just one idea can make a big difference. The point, yeah, you're mentioning the only lasting skill that you really can own and rely on is what you call this term, which is so, so beautiful. What's the term you use?
Skillful improvisation.
Yeah, because that's, it becomes a possession in you, in a sense.
Yeah.
All the other things are important. In fact, it also requires, make no mistake, a great deal of emotional and even spiritual maturity.
Absolutely.
To do that, because your ego must just be pushed to the side, you know? This is beautiful.
And yeah. And by the way, some of those skills might go. They may not be, because the situation changed, there's new skills required. So, for example, we talk a lot nowadays about digital learning.
Yes.
Digital learning is requiring skills that we didn't have before. So you have to build that into your toolkit now, but it might change later on depending on what kind of challenges or
needs. And you may then draw upon some of these later on when the crisis situation.
But some personality types are more inclined and can more easily, I would think, adapt to that skill,
right,
of improvisation, skillful improvisation. There's no doubt that if you look at the Enneagram or any of those, then they would, it would say to you, this personality type wants certainty.
Sure.
So therefore, it's going to be more difficult for this individual to acquire that skill. This individual can get the other 25 competencies, sure, under the knee and train hard and do the MBA and do leadership programs and read and go crazy. But when it comes to that improvisation, then he or she might have to work a little bit harder at it than another individual who's maybe more inclined to it.
It's also about building that flexibility, and Louis maybe can attest to it. It's that flexibility that we see in artists.
Yep.
Because artists think in a space of fluidity and not rigid, regimented stuff, you know. They are able to shift with the situation as is demand of them. Whereas I think a lot of our learning that happens in our traditional institutions, like, for example, business schools and even universities, often creates some regimentation rather than an openness. I think our education system, unfortunately, as I commented even at my son's school the other day, the education system, even though they put now on their curriculum, they want to put a subject called critical thinking. And I said, you better be very clear what you're saying, because the environment, to a large extent, with all of our practices, enforces conformity and not divergent thinking. So all of those systems that will work against you is not going to support what you're trying to pursue.
And critical thinking is not necessarily creative thinking.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's only element of it.
Yeah. So, and it's the same thing for leadership. Maybe one of the things which you did want to talk about is how would one define effectiveness and ineffectiveness?
Just before we go there,
okay.
So you're saying the future of leadership then means, if we can sort of close down that conversation, although
sure,
we can link back to it, there will be more skillful improvisation needed in the future.
Yes.
Am I right when I say
absolutely
that?
Absolutely.
Is it also right to assume in this VUCA world and the fact that change is picking up speed by the day, that it'll be exponential?
Yeah.
So I don't know, how does one then dig into the world of skillful improvisation? What does it take to be? And no doubt there'll be people who will write books about it and give you another 25 competencies to,
sure,
to break down what that means, because that's what we now need.
That perhaps brings us to talking about the effectiveness, because one of the things that we make a very strong point about in that particular chapter is to say, skillful improvisation is going to require digging very deep into ourselves.
Yes.
Partly because the environment outside is already taking so much away from us that to go and try and look for support outside there is not going to help us.
Yeah.
In fact, that environment is draining us rather than giving something back to us as a leader to step up.
It's extracting from you. It's not giving input almost.
It's just so it is. Mm. It's going to have to be. I believe. I mean, the model that we've been trying to pursue and what I've been a very strong proponent of is this inside-out model of leadership development. That we'll have to go and look first of all what is going on inside yourself as a leader to develop those personal skills that are required. But maybe the very first thing is going to be to deal with our blindness, because the beliefs and the mental models blinds us to reality. It blinds you to see only one component of reality and not the whole. Therefore, leaders find it so difficult to say to anybody in the workplace sometimes they don't know. And it's true that they don't know, but they can't say that, because don't know implies that I'm incompetent in my role, that and I must put up even an appearance of competence
and
in that
wrong.
Regard.
That increases stress.
But that is precisely what is happening, that people put up this very strong facade of competence, but sometimes it's okay to say you don't know. Because as one leadership commentator said to me, which makes a lot of sense to me, when a leader says, I don't know, he or she invites others in. And what he means by that is to say, when I say I don't know exactly what is the answer to the challenge we're facing, I'm asking you to comment on it. Maybe you've got a better idea than what
I have. In fact, I'm triggering the process to get the answer.
Exactly.
So I don't say I don't know and leave it there. Excellent.
No, it's not. It's simply making the point, obviously, in a kind of metaphorical way to say, when you make that comment, you are now inviting others to make a comment also on this challenge that you're dealing with.
You're asking a question.
But if I know everything, then I don't need your help to actually expand on the problem that we're dealing with.
It is a very nice way. I invite you in. Yeah, I look at leadership around, certainly in politics and maybe also in corporate, and there's definitely that attitude of I may not look vulnerable in front of my team and say I don't know.
Yeah.
But your leader is absolutely sure inside, who's dug deep and has walked that road that you speak of inside out, or what did you say?
The
inside out leadership model.
Yeah.
I've gone inside and I'm coming out. I think those are the leaders who are not afraid at all to demonstrate vulnerability.
Sure.
They do it with confidence. The more sure I am inside of who I am and where I'm going and what matters to me, the easier it is to improvise.
Yeah.
Because I know what to come back to.
Yeah.
If I don't know who I am and what my core is, with very deep roots these days, because the winds of change are blowing above the ground like crazy, the analogy of a tree, how do I come back? You know, and you see that with a lot of leaders. They think they know who they are. The winds of change blow. Things are crazy.
Yeah.
The organization's going under. Suddenly pops up a corrupt idea that can sort it out. I move away, and I never come back because I never knew who I was.
Sure.
I don't know if I'm making sense. I mean, that is so important.
In fact, in order to know, you need to first of all discover what blinds you. And Daniel Goleman, who is a big author, obviously, on the whole emotional intelligence, one of the first component, in fact, of emotional intelligence is self-management. That's what you have to do in the first instance before you can even begin to explore other things with other people. And he puts it so beautifully in this the way that he describes it. And he says, the range of what we think and do is limited by what we fail to notice. So effectively he's saying we are blind because we only see part of reality and not the whole. Although we operate as if we understand the whole, but we don't. We only know a very small component. Some people would even say that which we have gained as a reality through our senses only represent 1% of reality, but we act as if we know the 99%. But the 99 has to be discovered. So the first thing he says is that the range of what we think and do is limited by what we fail to notice. And then he goes on to say, and because we fail to notice that we fail to notice, there's little we can do to change until we notice our failing to notice limits our thoughts. And
I read that quote recently. It's brilliant. You fail to notice that you fail to notice.
Because what he's saying is that not only do we have a problem about blindness, of how our beliefs blinds us to reality, But secondly, we're not even aware that we are blind. So your unawareness of your blindness is a bigger problem, because if you are a bit like an alcoholic, you know, if an alcoholic says that day, I have a problem, when he speaks to the people and say, hi, my name is Andrew, I'm an alcoholic, he's saying, I'm owning my problem. That's the first thing you have to do. So you have to own your blindness first to create the awareness that that is going to hold you back from how you see reality. I think if organizations and leaders within organizations were just to open their eyes and see, I can't see everything here. It's impossible. It's just a natural impossibility, because our brains fundamentally restricts us to what we can or cannot see, because it selects. But a little bit, Adrian, I just want to challenge you also here now. Your mind is blocking out the humming of the aircon, but you are not aware of that. Your brain does that automatically, because it's focusing on some things while it excludes others, in order to focus and then to create a response.
And it has to.
Pardon?
As mortals, it has to.
Yes. Otherwise, we will not survive.
That's right.
The system will shut down if we have to try and... It's like a computer. It will be information overload. And the worst form of shutdown for human beings is obviously when you have a nervous breakdown, because there's too much information. You can't deal with it any longer. But by the way, we have breakdowns the whole day long when we shout at somebody and there's too much. You can't handle this boss that, you know, is so unreasonable.
That's why mindfulness has become so strong. Because if you really go down that route, among others, you can start observing others. You can start observing yourself. You can start observing the interaction right here as we sit here in your office.
Absolutely.
You know, what are all the dynamics around while observing and listening effectively? So mindfulness supposedly is part solution to all of that. Bring leadership ineffectiveness into this conversation?
So we would say that one of the first things that Chris Argyris does is that he helps us define what would we mean by effectiveness. And he's got a very simple definition, which I really like, because you can apply it in all instances. He says, effectiveness is the extent to which you achieve your intended consequences. And by that he means, we have a particular intention to achieve. Let's say a leader says, I want to build a high-performing team. That's my intention. Then I take certain actions, which, because it's about achieving, you're taking actions now to achieve what you intended. So you take certain actions. I give my people informal feedback. I don't wait until the end of the year only to give feedback. I do development. I coach on an ongoing basis. I point out where the person is on the right track as it happens, not like wait for later on. And you do all of those actions. So there's an intention. You take an action. And once you have taken the action, it leads to consequences. So the consequence could be that somebody from outside say to you, but your team plays so beautifully together and how they achieve what they set out to do, it means you have been able to achieve your intention.
Yeah.
So effectiveness is the extent to which you achieve your intended consequences. Now, that is premised on the fact that there's synchronization between your intention, your action, and the outcomes.
Yeah.
But we know more often than not in life there's a mismatch between the intention and the action, and certainly the consequence thereof.
Is that because of the VUCA world?
It's partly because of that. It is an environment, obviously, that creates a problem. But in action science, which is what Chris Argyris is talking about, it has to do with the mental models that drives us. And I'm going to give you a specific example, because I interviewed senior executives on this particular issue to see how they deal with it. So one of the things you would ask them is to say, what kind of leadership style do you have? I mean, it could be various questions, but I asked this one executive, what is your leadership style? And he says it is hands-off leadership style. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's... ideally, it's what we would like leadership to look like. It's hands off, because you have coached, you have done everything, then you step back and let people do it themselves. So I said to him, illustrate for me with concrete example, what do you mean by hands off leadership style? He was the owner of a major motor dealership. So he was talking about his sales manager. So he says, what I would do is I go and sit with my sales manager at his computer. We check how many leads has he had for that particular week, for example, or month. How many of those leads were cold? Which ones did he follow up? And so on. And you must talk to this person in this particular way. Now, what did you hear me just say around him illustrating that?
That is not hands-off.
He was telling actually hands-on leadership. Mm. And yet he believed that he was operating from a hands-off type of style. I'll give you another example because it was actually brilliantly illustrated by him. And when I pointed it out to him, his eyes kind of just opened. He said one of the things he does with his sales team is that once a month on a Wednesday, they have a scrum session. And the scrum session was a rough session whereby we're really going to take you out. You haven't met your targets and we are putting our heads, like in rugby, we're putting our heads into the scrum and it's sweaty in there and it's really rough, okay? And people are putting ideas forward how to deal with this particular issue so long they do what I want in the end.
Yes.
That's what he said. So he was demonstrating an unconsciousness that the mental model that was driving him was actually hands-on leadership, although he publicly espoused a hand-off leadership. And he couldn't understand why is it that with this hands-off leadership style that he was expounding himself and wanting to believe in and telling people that he was actually very much manifesting that kind of behavior, he couldn't understand why was he not achieving his consequences of this hands-off.
Interesting.
And the consequence of this hand-off would have been for him to be able to say, my sales manager is actually doing the things that are really beginning to make his business, the sales, very effective. And I just had to stand back and support him and giving him some coaching here and there. But effectively, he and his team was doing that stuff. Mm. He couldn't achieve that. And he couldn't understand why he's spending so much time on doing exactly the opposite. So the mental model that was driving him was hands-on, although he believed in the mental model that he espoused his hands-off. That is a very good example of how this ineffectiveness is driven by mental models. It's not a chance thing. It's actually what we tacitly believe already. And that drives our behavior. So one way of overcoming that, obviously, is to help a person create awareness. What is the mental model, as I've just demonstrated to you?
That's holding.
So one way to demonstrate it is to say, what do you believe? And then give an illustration, because the illustration must then be in synchronization with what your intention is. So it is about, what is that intention? What is the action and what's the outcome?
And then understanding your mental models that will stop you from being effective.
Of course.
So the mental model potentially becomes the ineffective leadership instigator almost.
That's fundamentally what we would say from action science, effectiveness lies in that. Your context, like this VUCA context we're talking about, it could make it more complex for you. There's no doubt about it. But we are saying that you need to get into the space of understanding first, how do you view this VUCA context? Because if you're stepping from, it's just an intellectual thing that you're dealing with, no, it's not going to help you. You need to get into your belief system that drives your behavior. And if you can't deal with that, you cannot even be effective. Even if you understand the VUCA world effectively, you're not going to be effective in that.
So, Arden, that's why our hard-won experience confirms so much what you're saying, Doctor. We speak of understanding your personal drivers,
absolutely,
etc., which, of course, you won't recognize until it's borne out to you. It's incredible how this impacts on your behavior. Then you speak of understand what you're doing wrong. We speak of the intruder principle.
Sure.
These are intruders to your authentic self.
Right.
And I just love the way that you've been bringing beautiful research in, and we appreciate that immensely.
Yeah.
The authentic self, that's the key to leadership.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed. So all of those concepts like authentic, a leader of integrity, begin to make sense if you can show you have dealt with your blindness. That, I am afraid to say, is not an easy task, because what has to happen now, Adrian, is a leader who, you know, says to himself that I've been a very effective leader, I've been a leader now for the last 20 years. And you're saying to the person, actually what you've been pursuing for these last 20 years is not a belief that really make you very effective. And to let go of it, that's not easy. Yeah. Because the belief system is actually built up in us from childhood. Mm. And that begins to influence how we interpret the world, our relationship, how do we make sense of what's going on around us. A clinical psychologist, for example, would say that our belief system is in place by the age of 7.
God, it's just
the last time, the last time that we were free human beings was maybe at the age of 2, because we still dictate what needs to happen, and soon our wishes and our desires have to conform with what is happening around us in society. In the first instance, our parents, who says there are certain things you can do and not others. Mm. And I will demonstrate that to you, and the way maybe we grew up, our generation, was that at some point that belief was enforced on you. My grandmother had a brown leather strap that was written on Klaar gepraat. So there's no more talking after that. Now she will take action. And that action is going to determine that you have to do it, because you know there are consequences.
Yeah. Andrew, as we start winding down the last 4 or 5 minutes of our leadership masterclass, I mean, the context within which you've learned this and much more is the ESCOM environment. I also want us to end off with SIOPSA. It's an organization you're part of that's fascinating, that people need to know of. But ESCOM, I mean, it's a crazy environment.
Sure.
It's been part of the narrative in our country for many years now, mostly for bad leadership. Yet I know you're doing a heck of a lot of good work here. So how have you navigated through that? And
and
is this part of, is it this tough environment that's taught you some of these lessons?
Yeah.
I mean, we again, in most organizations, people are developing at great cost leaders, but we're not always seeing the results.
Yeah.
You know, somehow, in my view, collectively speaking, leadership development has failed the world.
Sure.
Okay, because for many reasons, and we've had those conversations on the show. Just a minute or so on what you've learned in this environment.
And I think the learning can only be in a space of adversity, because if it is going well, then there's very little that you need to learn about it. And one of those things that I'm reminded of is what Kurt Levine, the father of action research, basically would be talking about. And he says, there's nothing more practical than a good theory. So you have to have a clear idea in your mind, first of all, what you want to do. So when we talk about, say, an inside-out model of learning, then you need to begin to apply it. Okay, so that's what we did. And I can tell you that the very fact that ESCOM actually is still operating, and I mean, there were times when it was really bad the way it operated and then better, and yet it kept going, means that there are thousands of people, including leaders within ESCOM, who are just trying to make their contribution to making this thing work. And I think a lot of them, when we get feedback from those managers, because remember, we train from supervisor all the way up to executives, is that a lot of those leaders would say, when we went through the programs here, it helped me also to take personal responsibility of what I have to do. Because I could say, well, all the things that are going so wrong at senior levels within the organization, I can hide behind it and do nothing. And yet a lot of those people, where we help them to build the skills to step up to their challenge, because one of the questions I often ask the leader is, do you know clearly what is your scope of influence? And do you believe you've got some control about what happens within your scope of influence? Well, if you believe that, then get on with it, because you can't wait for all of these things to be resolved and you're not dealing with the issues that you find in your particular scope of influence. And I think a lot of leaders have stepped up to it. Often get derailed with what is happening in the broader context, obviously. And I have a firm belief, I say it often to my team, that I believe that which we had been able to do so well with the executive team when in the early, like 2012, 13, 11, around that time, when we built a leadership at senior level, the executive team, because when we embark on the leadership programs, the first thing I said to the CEO at the time was, you must also be subject to that very same training.
I'm guessing Brian Dalmas.
Brian Dalmas in this particular instance. Because I said to him, and I convinced him, first of all, you're saying that that which you have such an expectation to see in your leaders in the organization, you are building exactly the same thing in yourself, but you're also preparing yourself to be a coach and mentor to people around you. How do we tackle what is my journey? Is also now how do I am stepping up to helping you to do that. And I think I think there's real possibilities for us to do it. And I believe we did make major inroads even in that middle management layer. I almost have a belief, hopefully it's expressing real hope in me, is that if we can sort out again what is happening at this higher level, it's simply to unlock what is sitting dormant now maybe in many people in Eskom.
It's a lot of people say, oh, we don't need the top politicians or we don't need a president of the country. We can sort things out on ground level. There's some truth to that. But the truth is we must have an ethical, good leader at the top of South Africa who instills a certain culture in an organization.
Comes back to yourself.
And the same with Eskom, anywhere else. You know, you can't have rot at the top, let's say, but expect the rest of the organization to not have it, or weak leadership at the top and not. So good luck with that journey. We'll have you back on for sure. Just very quickly, SEOPSA, just 1 minute on what they are, because it seems to be a bit of a hidden gem.
Yeah, so one of the approaches which I wanted to take up with you at the moment, I represent SEOPSA on the external affairs. SEOPSA is the Society of Industrial and Organizational Psychology in South Africa. And it's the professional society for all industrial psychologists. Mm. It's not compulsory because you just have to register with the Health Professions Council at the moment. And we are the professional society that manages the whole spectrum of what could be considered to be psychology in the workplace. And that covers a whole spectrum of things, whether it is your training and development, whether it's talent acquisition, whether it is even ER, because we have to learn that, or HR management, all the skills in that, career management, psychometrics, which is obviously one of the key components that we deliver within organization. So it's covering the whole spectrum of issues within the workplace. Organizational change is a key component of what. So the society is trying to manage how does that profession begin to step up to that role more effectively within the workplace. I think one of the challenges of industrial psychologists in the past have always been that we got painted, and we painted ourselves into a corner of just doing psychometrics. But it's probably just a tool in our hands to do these other things that I've just spoken to you about.
Correct.
And what we're wanting to do now, and what I'm taking up for the society, is to help bring that into the public sphere. It's almost like saying to interested parties out there, like media houses and so on, if you want to have comment on really topical issues within the workplace, we have experts available that can speak to this issue. And my role is to go and help connect them in with those external institutions to say, do you want to comment on stress in the workplace? We've got people that can talk about it. Neuro leadership, for example, we have got people and so forth.
Yeah. So we'll certainly, we want to connect more with that, and through our leadership app that we'll be launching, that will be out there very soon. That's the typical expertise that we can place on there too.
Sure.
Thank you so much, Dr. Andrew Johnson, Chief Learning Officer at Eskom. What a rich conversation. Let's all work on that skillful. The word in my mind is adaptation.
But improvisation.
Improvisation. Is it the same thing?
Yeah. No, not adaptation, because improvise, adaptation almost assumes that you're stepping and you're just adapting to that environment. Improvisation means you're still responding to it in a very active way.
Yeah, positive
response.
All right, thank you so much. The Leadership Platform for all things leadership. And of course, that's our Leadership Masterclass. The Old Man Louis Groenewald, thank you for being with us. And Dr. Andrew Johnson, look forward to being with you again next week. Thank you for joining us.
This is CliffCentral.com.